This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Ever wonder what gives the tennis ball its signature bounce, or how the taser gets its knockout punch, or even how a fire extinguisher is put together?
I'm here at Ansel Incorporated, where I've just seen a 20-inch sheet of metal become what will be the tank of a Red Lion fire extinguisher. These extinguishers are designed to combat some of the worst industrial fires in the world. The workers here have welded them, shaped them, and washed them. Now it's time to give them their distinctive color.
The National Geographic Channel and engineer Marshall Brain give us a fascinating behind-the-scenes look in the new series Factory Floor with Marshall Brain. This hour, we'll move from conveyor belts to durability labs to the final product, everything you've ever wanted to know about what it takes to make some of our most common products. If you want to talk with him about how ordinary things are made, from tennis balls and escalators to fireworks and frozen pizza, or if you make any of them, give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255, or send an email to talk@npr.org. And, of course, you can send us your comments on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Marshall Brain is the host of Factory Floor with Marshall Brain. He is the founder of the website How Stuff Works, and he joins us now from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. And, you know, one of the very intriguing things that we learned from this show is that some of our sidewalks have tennis balls in them. Can you explain that?
Well, so we visit these factories on the show, and they all have byproducts. And in the case of the tennis ball factory, when they cut the tennis balls out, they get these little bits of rubber left over. So they actually incorporate those into the asphalt of the streets of Phoenix, and you're driving on tennis balls as you drive around town.
That's pretty funny. And, you know, one thing I was completely struck by as I was watching this show is how elaborate these factories are. I kept thinking of those old Rube Goldberg cartoons where he drew these very elaborate contraptions to show you how to, you know, get a drink of water or something like that. It's amazing. And particularly the tennis ball factory. It seemed to have, you know, 500 parts to make this one little tennis ball.
Right. And you're exactly right about the Rube Goldberg machine. This is like the highest creative art form in our society, and it's completely hidden from us. But it, you know, it's easy to imagine making one pizza or one tennis ball, but when you want to make like 300,000 tennis balls in a day and do it efficiently and have them all be perfect, then you end up with Rube Goldberg machines of the highest order.
Who makes all these parts? And how do people figure out, you know, all the parts that need to be made in order to put two halves of rubber together that form the inside of the tennis ball?
Well, there's a giant infrastructure that builds the machines, you know, for example, that stuff hot dogs. There's a whole sausage stuffing machinery industry trade group that publishes a magazine. And that's one way. But the other way is the factories actually make their own equipment. So the tennis ball factory makes the equipment that puts the felt around the ball. And that, you know, allowed them to take enough of the human effort out that they can still make those balls in the United States cost effectively.
Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things that you also learn in the show is why certain things have these signature colors. For instance, the tennis ball. Where does its color come from? The yellow tennis balls,
right,
in particular.
Well, you can get them in almost any color, but the main color is this super fluorescent green, and that's because it shows up so well to people. It shows up well if it's against the sky. It shows up well against the court, against trees that might be in the background. It's just a great color for the human eye.
And what about pencils? That was another interesting little factoid. Pencils, the, you know, number two pencil, there's a show about how that is made. And why are they yellow?
Well, they're yellow for like a 100-year-old reason, because when they were first being manufactured with Chinese graphite, they wanted a color that would say we're from China. And yellow is a royal emperor color in China. And so it got started over a century ago, and that just echoes forward, and we still are using yellow pencils today.
I love that. And something about the show about the pencils that was so interesting was that factory, I guess you call it, but the place where they made those pencils, I felt like I was looking at a Charles Dickens novel or something. It was so dark and dank and kind of scary looking.
A lot of factories are good sets for movies, yes. So in the case of that factory, they've got, you know, all the graphite powder that kind of coats everything. That same thing happened in the tire factory where they're using carbon black to color the tires. And it gets on everything. It gets on you. You come out of some of these factories and you're a different color and you definitely are a different smell.
Oh, yeah.
And they're incredibly loud. A lot of times you're just screaming, to talk to someone because it's so loud in a lot of these factories.
You mentioned the smells more than once, and I kept thinking, well, I wonder what that's like. I wonder what he's smelling right now. I can't remember a good example, but maybe you can give me one where there's a really powerful smell.
Several. Like in the tennis ball factory, the glues they're using are all hexane-based, which is a really volatile, kind of sweet-smelling, hallucinogenic chemical that is, it's just a very distinctive smell. And then curing rubber has an amazing difficult to breathe all day long kind of smell as well. And the felt has a smell. And so there's just a lot of odor in most factories. And if it's a rubber factory, it's very overpowering. But a beer factory smells like hops and a chocolate factory smells like chocolate. And it's just everyone is completely different.
Now, what do you think it is that makes people interested in this kind of a show and sort of seeing the behind the scenes way that something is made? It's a very simple object, really. What is it that fascinates people so much about that kind of process, do you think?
Well, the first thing is the fact that we use this stuff every day. So, we all eat frozen pizza and we all hit tennis balls and use number two pencils. And, it's a common thing in our life. And it's cool to see how it actually gets put together. But the other thing is the Rube Goldberg aspect you were talking about is that to make one thing is really quite easy, but to make a million of them and to do it efficiently, they're having to use so much creativity and so much engineering and so much money. Just the money is mind-boggling in these factories. Like the beer factory is, I think it's 17 football fields is the size of the mm-hmm. thing, and they've got 20 million gallons of beer they're racking inside there to age it. And the size, the scale is unbelievable. And people just, it's interesting. It's really interesting to see the problems they're solving.
We're talking with Marshall Brain about National Geographic's new show, Factory Floor, with Marshall Brain. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. And we're going to take a call now from Susan. And Susan is calling from Locke, New York. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I build handheld scanners in Skaneateles Atlas Falls, New York. And I don't know if you've ever done a program on this item, but my job is going to China next year, so if you want to get to it, you better get to it soon.
Oh, really?
Yes, but we do it from beginning to end. We have sources in the area for the plastics and other items that go into these scanners. But I've been here 24 years.
And which part do you do? Do you have one particular job that you do?
No, towards the final end where I help to assemble the scanner itself. But the process for this goes from populating the boards right up to the end, packing and shipping.
And have you ever thought of your job as being a really interesting job that people would find fascinating to kind of watch how this is done?
Personally, I did when I started working here. I thought it was quite interesting. I don't know about everyone else, but I've always felt. And then I've seen it grow through the times from being a fiber optic scanner to now small digitals and little cameras, and I've seen a lot happen in the years that I've been here.
Well, Susan, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And Marshall, have you thought about, have you gone to that kind of a factory, or does that sound familiar to you?
she brings up a really interesting point that some factories are moving to China or Mexico, and some factories are actually moving back as the dollar, the valuation of the dollar has changed. So a lot of the factories that are here in the United States are here, you know, like the tennis ball factory or the airbag factory or the beer factory. They're here because the dynamics of the economy and the amount of automation they can bring actually makes it cheaper to do it in the United States. So the movement of factories back and forth is a pretty dynamic thing right now. A lot of the electronic stuff is done in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea, because they've just built up a really big infrastructure for handling almost, you know, no televisions are made in the United States pretty much anymore. They've just taken over that. But like I said, almost all the airbags in the United States are produced right here in, you know, in Utah and in other factories around the country. So it just depends on the product.
Was there one factory that was more fascinating than any of the others that fascinated you the most?
Oh, my gosh. Like, every one has a part that just blows you away. And then, you know, like the Learjet factory was particularly interesting. We went to four of those, I think, because they make it, you know, in different parts of the world. So there's a factory in Canada we went to. We went to one in Ireland. There's Kansas City where they made it all together. And then we got to go on a test flight. But, you know, like the pasta factory, they're making spaghetti and they're making like a million pounds of it a day. And one of the really unbelievable things that I never would have thought of was that they optically take a picture of every single grain of wheat as it comes into the factory. So they have a million pounds of wheat, and let's say there's, I have no idea, let's say there's 50,000 kernels in a pound. So they're looking at 50 billion grains of wheat individually every day with a camera and kicking out anyone that isn't the right shape or the right color or, you know, the right weight. It's just, why would you inspect every single grain of wheat? And it's because they don't want little flecks of black or, you know, a rock getting into their pasta. It's, they're obsessed with perfection.
That's amazing. Marshall Brain will be joining us after a short break. He'll stay with us as we continue to discuss the new National Geographic Channel program, Factory Floor, with Marshall Brain. I'm Lynn Neary, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We've probably all wondered what gives fireworks their pop or batteries their zip. Marshall Brain decided to find out and share it with the rest of us. He's the creator of HowStuffWorks.com and the host of Factory Floor with Marshall Brain on the National Geographic Channel. And if you'd like to talk with him, give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send an email to talk@npr.org. And Marshall, you've discovered a lot of myths on this show, uncovered a lot of myths, I should say. For instance, what are hot dogs really made of?
You know, you hear so much about hot dogs. But in the case of the hot dogs we visited, we went to the Sabret factory in the Bronx, of all places, and they're making them out of bull meat. So it's nothing but bull meat and fat, and that's it, with spices and some salt and, you know, a preservative. That's all that's in it. So there's no chicken beaks and there's no, you know, other weird stuff that you've always heard about. It's just the meat that comes when you take the bones out of a bull.
But and the natural color, I learned too, is gray.
Right, yes. Well, they, you know, the meat has this reddish color as it comes into the factory, but if it were to just sit without the sodium nitrite in it, it would turn gray, right? And people don't find that appetizing, so they just add this little bit in there to keep the color the way people like it.
All right, let's go to Jason now, calling from Wisconsin. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I work in the industrial automation sector. We actually distribute a major product line. And just wanted to comment on paper. People don't realize they use it every day, write on it, use it to blow their nose and other things. But the size of the machines that make these pieces of paper are massive. We're talking like a couple city blocks long and up to 2 to 3 stories high. Just wondering if you've ever been into a paper manufacturer, and I'd like to hear any comments you have on that.
Excellent. We went to two paper factories. One made the paper that money is printed on, and that's made out of cotton and linen, and is this amazing high-security process. Only one factory in the country that makes the paper that goes into bills and passports and all of that. And then we also went to a toilet paper factory where they're making toilet paper out of wood fiber. And the machines there were of the size that you're describing. They're making a lot of toilet paper, and they're making it incredibly fast. So
they're huge machines. I just wanted to comment that the rolls that come off of these are just massive, like tons of paper, and then there's
paper, right.
The different sizes. And go ahead.
So they use this giant Yankee cylinder to dry this paper. So you have this water slurry coming on one end, and about 4 seconds later, there's dry paper coming off the other end because the machine is able to just suck the water out of it in just a few seconds. It's startling to watch. And then they crepe it at the end to make it soft like toilet paper is, and it goes onto a roll. And you're standing there looking at it, and it seems impossible because it's 99% water on the left side, and it's paper that's dry on the right side, and you can see it happen. It's only taken a few seconds to turn from water to paper.
Wow.
So it's amazing that they get it all to work 24 hours a day. You know, and it's solid and reliable and perfect.
Jason, thanks so much for your call.
You bet.
We're going to go to Michigan now. We're going to go to Calvin, and Calvin is calling from Holland, Michigan. Hi, Calvin.
Hey, how are you doing? Hey, I just wonder, you know, every day we open our car doors and stuff like that, and I actually had the opportunity to work in a plant that made car doors. And I don't think anybody ever gives any thought to the fact of how is that made. You know, you have the tubing and stuff like that. Well, it was actually done by roll forming. And I wonder if you had any experience in a roll forming type plant.
We went to the Hyundai factory in Alabama, and this factory was mind-bogglingly big. It was acres and acres and acres. And they start with rolls of steel at one end of the factory, and they stamp them out, and they shape them, and then there's this shocking gigantic robotic welding system. So, you know, pieces of metal go in one end and car bodies come out the other end, and nobody touches it in between. And then, you know, the car body has to get painted and rust proofed. And then, you know, so there's a whole building for that. And there's a whole building that makes the engines that go in. And then, you know, they put all the seats on it and it all comes together and boom, a Hyundai Sonata drives out the other end. And then they have a test track and you drive it around and nearly throw up on the test track. And then there's a parking lot with 20,000 Sonatas in it at the other end of the facility. It's just, it's mind-boggling. And the amount of money that went into making all of that, it just is impossible to comprehend sometimes.
All right.
One more comment. You're also, we're talking about the odors. I also had the opportunity to work in a Heinz plant where we made the relish, pickle relish.
Oh, wow.
I will never eat pickle relish again. I only worked there 3 days, and I had to go. Just could not handle the aroma.
That is, pickles are an amazing aroma. You're right.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Calvin. Yeah,
thank you.
Well, you know, I wondered that as I was watching the hot dog show, whether people would eat those hot dogs again, and certainly if the people in the factory eat the hot dog.
Well, we're standing right there on the line. I probably ate 10 hot dogs
Yeah,
that
you
day.
Did. That's right.
So, you know, you have to do multiple takes and stuff, and they're great. I love hot dogs, so
It didn't turn
evangelist.
You off seeing those big...
No.
All right, okay. All right, here's a good email from Jeff. He says, I was wondering if, in general, the methods you show for manufacturing parts is state-of-the-art. I can't imagine my company letting any information out about our current processes. How restricted is the information you're allowed to show?
Excellent point. And so the factories run the gamut. So the pencil factory, as you commented on, is Dickinsonian in its – I mean, the machines are 80 years old, and they've been making pencils the same way forever. But then you go to the Trek factory where they make carbon fiber bicycles, and they are very, very particular about what you're allowed to film and what you're not allowed to film. But they're also, you know, very nice about it. Factory folks are the nicest people in the world, in my experience. Just unbelievably knowledgeable and competent and solid. Just, you know, every single person you meet in a factory is a remarkable person, it turns out. So you go to the Trek factory, and there's 300 folks hand-assembling these little bits of carbon fiber to make a fork for a bicycle or a, you know, a tube or something. And they're doing this very meticulously after 2 weeks of training and exactly how to put these things down. And, you know, they show us the whole process, and then they tell us what we can actually air and not. And you get to see exactly what happens, but you don't get to see the really proprietary top secret parts of the process that they're trying to protect.
All right, here's an email from Dave. He says, what about building assembly line machines? Are they commissioned to engineering firms? And regarding their daily or monthly cycles, do they run 24/7? And if not, are the first products as it begins and last as it winds down throwaways, similar to some printing presses?
Excellent. So let's take the first part. A lot of these factories do run 24/7. Like Hyundai runs, I believe their cycle was 8 hours on, 4 hours for maintenance, 8 hours on, 4 hours for maintenance, and they just do that all the time. And a glass factory can't shut down, because once you heat up this giant furnace full of molten glass, there's no turning it off, really, without it just being a total mess. So most factories seem to run on a 24-hour basis. Remind me of another thing he asked.
Okay, and he wanted to know if not, well, you said most do, but he wanted to know if when the first products as it begins and the last as it winds down, are they throwaways, which he says is similar to some printing presses.
Right. So, you know, like we went to a big ice cream factory, which was fantastic. Yeah, we ate so much ice cream, you can't even imagine. But there, you know, lines are starting and stopping inside the factory, and you know, cups get jammed in machines and stuff like that. So there are just big trash bins alongside all the lines. And yes, everything that doesn't, you know, gets jammed or doesn't fill properly, or, you know, they have all these automated inspection tools that are weighing the cartons and checking for metal in the cartons. And, you know, so you have machines kicking stuff out. So yes, there is a lot of rejects that are getting trapped in the factory, put in the trash, probably recycled in some way, because all of these factories are incredibly conscious about reusing, recycling, because it's money out the door if they throw this stuff away. So they're really thinking hard about how to avoid waste and how to reuse it.
And Dave has one last question that I'm kind of curious about. I'm giving him too many questions here, maybe. But what about building assembly line machines? Are they commissioned to engineering firms? I'm really curious about how those machines get built, too. How do they get built?
Right. It's different for every factory. So, for example, the Autoliv factory that makes airbags, they custom make every machine because every airbag is unique to every model of car. So it has to fit into the steering wheel of a certain car, and the shape of the airbag is different. So they're custom building the machines that pack it into the steering wheel and fold it and all that, and they're doing that in-house. And that's not uncommon. But, for example, the hot dog factory, they're, like I said, there's an industry that makes sausage stuffing equipment, and so they go out into this ecosystem and buy the machines that they're using to stuff their hot dogs. So it just depends on the factory and what they're doing, but it's a mix of industry. You can outsource to an engineering firm. You can make it in-house. It just depends on the economics.
All right, let's go to Bob in Sunnyvale, California. Hi, Bob.
Hey. I've been very fortunate to have worked in the industrial construction sector for most of my adult life. And I've had the opportunity to work at, like, Campbell Soup and Goodyear Tire and, and Frito-Lay and, you know, a couple of these companies. The process of watching potato chips being made or Doritos is an incredible process. But the two plants that I've worked in that I had the most satisfaction out of, just kind of a gee whiz moment, was a cigarette plant in North Carolina, because cigarettes are very fragile items, you know, that could be damaged real easily. And another one is Devereux Teapack in South Carolina, who makes sausage casing.
Okay.
Have you ever had any contact with either one of these industries?
We did not go to a cigarette factory, and the sausage casings came to the hot dog factory already, you know, possibly from that company. Are you talking natural casings or the cellulose casings?
There's cellulose casings from natural products made by a company called Devereaux Tea Pack in Sandy Run, South Carolina.
I can't help thinking that both of those places would have a pretty strong odor. Did they, Bob?
They did. The cigarette plant, after you worked there, I worked there for over a year adding on to the plant, and the one in Cabarrus County, North Carolina. And, you know, after you get there for the first, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, then you kind of get used to it. And then, of course, everything you've got smells like cigarettes and, you know, tobacco. But, you know, talking about a Rube Goldberg machine, I mean, from the time that it comes in, a hogshead of tobacco leaf comes into one end of the plant, and it's a case of Marlboros, you know, going to wherever, you know, out the other end of the plant. And in most cases, human hands never touch it. And it's just interesting to me. I mean, you know, I don't smoke and never have, but cigarettes are a very fragile commodity, even more fragile than automotive windshields, which I've also worked in a PPG plant.
Wow. Well, Bob, thanks so much for calling in. We're gonna move on to another caller now. But thanks so much for your call.
Okay.
And I just want to remind our audience that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to take a call now from Guy, and Guy is calling from Reno, Nevada. Hi, Guy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, go ahead.
I was interested if he had looked at the production of electricity through power generation stations and the distribution associated with it, because we actually produce electricity.
I don't know. Marshall?
With the National Geographic Channel, we did not go to a power plant, but I have been to the to the nuclear power plant here in Raleigh, Sharon Harris, and seen that process, and then walked through. You know, it comes out of the power plant, it goes to a distribution hub, goes out all over, you know, the eastern part of North Carolina, and spreads out through all these substations and wires, and followed it all the way down to the pole in front of my house, and that is a startling amount of infrastructure and time, and then the maintenance of it and the dealing with it when a hurricane goes through. And like, human beings, when they cooperate together to build things like that, just boggle the mind. We are an amazing species when we work together to do something like that. And electricity is a perfect example, because it works basically all the time, you know, unless a big storm goes through or something. It's super reliable, super cheap, and we all use it like oxygen. We don't even realize it until, you know, the day it goes out.
That's right. And it's and a lot of people just don't have a clue as to how it gets there or
right.
what the issues are involved into producing it. I mean, I do it at the generation level, so we actually produce, you know, megawatts, put them out on the grid. There's also a whole industry as far as support's concerned, you know,
right.
Because some are, you know, gas turbines, some are boilers. It depends on, you know, what mode they use to produce electricity, and it's
right.
Complex.
All right, thanks so much for your call, Guy.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
I'm going to see if I can get one more call in here before we have to go. Let's go to Dave in Kansas City. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I worked for a company that made machines that did paper converting stuff. They would make different things out of paper. Envelopes
right.
at 1,000 a minute. One of them was a a panty liner machine. That is just a hoot. When you go to watch those, they're 1,000 a minute. They and at the end of the quality control, they weigh them, they measure them, they stretch them, they pull them, they tear them apart, they smell them. It's just an incredible sight to see.
Okay.
And everyone is perfect when it comes off the line.
And when they go in the machine, the hammer mill rips up cardboard and makes the material that actually soaks up the product. And then as it comes out the other end, It's folded up, put in little plastic packages, slid into the box you buy at the store, and slid into a case that's shipped in.
All right. All right. Well, that's a good one to end on. Thanks so much, Dave.
You bet.
Thanks for calling. So I guess just one last question I have for you before we have to go. In one of these shows, sure. you went to a taser factory and you let them tase you. How did that feel?
It was shocking. Your entire body tenses, and it's incredibly burning, painful, and then it's off.
All right.
And you're back.
All right, we got to go. Marshall, thanks so much for joining us. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Marshall Brain is the host of Factory Floor with Marshall Brain. It airs tonight on the National Geographic Channel, and he joined us from North Carolina Public Radio. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, This American Moment. Since the Democratic and Republican conventions a few weeks ago, we've been asking politicians, journalists, writers, and thinkers to take a step back to put this election and this campaign season in context, to tell us what's at stake, what this election means to them. In a few moments, we'll hear from author and activist Eboo Patel. A devoted Muslim, Patel cares passionately about working with young people to shape their leadership and nurture them toward an idea of religious pluralism, what Patel calls the big idea of our time. We also want to know what This American Moment means to you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org, and you may comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Eboo Patel is director of the Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago, and he joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Great to be back, Lynn.
Now, your blog is called The Faith Divide, and I wanted to know why it's called that, and what do you mean by the divide?
I think we're living at a time in which the clash of civilizations seems to be acquiring the force of inevitability. I mean, you look at the evening news or you check out the daily newspaper, and what you seem to see is people from different religious backgrounds at each other's throats all the time. And what we do at the Interfaith Youth Corps is to say that doesn't have to be the case. Religious traditions are not inevitably divided. They're not inherently at odds with each other. And what we have to do is, instead of looking at the world as Muslim versus Christian, which is what the clash of civilizations wants us to do, we have to look at the world as those who are building pluralism versus those who are advancing extremism. And so what the faith divide is really about is trying to find people who are bridging it.
Do you also see the divide as being between those who are secular and those who are religious?
I think that that's something else that needs to be bridged, absolutely. And I think the foundation of these bridges is shared values: compassion, dignity, equality, fairness, hospitality. These are values in Islam, in Christianity, in Judaism, in secular humanism. And what we need to be focusing on is how our particular traditions bring us to act upon those values, which is, you know, what we do at the Interfaith Youth Corps is we're training young people to be leaders in identifying those values and then bringing people from different backgrounds together to act upon them.
So what does this American moment, this moment in our nation's life, mean to you? What is the most important thing to you?
I think what we have to be doing in America right now is living up to the dream of pluralism. You know, George Washington had at his inauguration in 1789 a Jewish clergy person. He wanted to send the signal very early in this nation's history that we are a place in which people from different religious backgrounds can live in equal dignity and mutual loyalty. One of my favorite sayings from George Washington is that the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land shall continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants. And if you look at so many of our great figures through history, Martin Luther King Jr., Jane Addams, Dorothy Day, Thomas Jefferson, what you find is people who say America is a nation that is a place where people from the four corners of the world come together and built a country. And that's remarkable, and that's unique. And at this time in history, America needs to give a lie to the clash of civilizations. We need to be the model that shows the rest of the world that Muslims and Christians, that Hindus and Jews, that secularists and believers can live together in equal dignity and mutual loyalty.
Well, to what degree do you see that actually happening in this country at this time? And let's say in this election at this time, since we are sort of trying to step back and take a look at this election from a broader perspective, let's say.
Right. Well, one of the things I find striking about Barack Obama is in his book, particularly Dreams for My Father, he basically writes about his personal quest for identity, finding coherence amidst the multiplicity of who he is. Part Kenya, part Kansas, part white, part black, part corporate lawyer, part community organizer. And in that personal quest for identity, he discovers the identity of his nation. America is also all of those things. And as Walt Whitman once said, I am wide, I contain multitudes. And I think the American challenge right now, this beautiful challenge that we have is to live up to what Michael Walzer once said, which is that the challenge and promise of America is to embrace its differences and maintain a common life. And I think what's interesting is that in the biography of one of our candidates, that's so starkly evidenced.
And yet we still see a nation that seems to be pretty divided, at least politically. How does religious pluralism in any way become, or is it possible for what you are discussing, this idea of religious pluralism, to become a way towards getting away from the division that we see in this country politically?
Well, I think that one of the things that we can learn how to do is to both affirm our particularity and contribute to pluralism. It's one of the things that the Muslim community is doing right now, following very much from what African Americans and Jews and Catholics and other minority and immigrant communities did in the past, which is to say that we are realizing that in order for us to live free, in order for us to have dignity and to be fair, and to have fairness, we need to contribute to a nation in which everybody feels free, in which everybody feels like they have dignity, in which everybody feels treated fairly. That was very much the modus operandi of the civil rights movement. King would say over and over again, this is not just about African Americans. This is about all Americans. And you build a country where everybody feels like they live in equal dignity and mutual loyalty by saying that you recognize you share a huge part of your humanity with your neighbor. And if your neighbor goes down, you go down.
All right, let's see if we can get a call here. And I just want to tell our listeners that if you would like to join in our discussion of This American Moment with Eboo Patel, the number is 800-989-8255. We're going to go to Nulia, who is calling from Newport, Oregon. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to support your idea of plurality because you see divisions like that even within Christianity. And so if people want to be divisive and fight about things, they'll find something to find as a difference even within their same small groups. So I just think it's an incredibly important idea.
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
I think that Nulia was just affirming what you've been saying. And I wanted to ask you something about your latest blog entry where you write that evangelicals may be more open to religious diversity than in the past. And I was wondering why you say that now. What makes you think that at this moment?
I think that you have a powerful new movement emerging in evangelical Christianity, and I count people like Rick Warren and Bill Hybels at Willow Creek Church and Jim Wallace at Sojourners and Rich Sizek at the National Association of Evangelicals and many others as friends and mentors. And one of the ways that they are friends and mentors of mine is by showing how they can hold on to their particular distinct religious traditions and contribute to a country in which Muslims, like me, feel free and feel like we're treated with dignity. And part of what they say is, you know, look, Eboo, we might in some cases have different ideas about heaven, but we share together earth. We share together a nation. And what we need to be doing is making sure that people of all backgrounds can thrive together in this nation. And they think that that's a big part of their religious identities. And I have to tell you, it reminds me of one of the Christians that I admire most in the 20th century, and that's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor who opposed Hitler's Nazi Germany. And after a Kristallnacht, which was one of the first forays of the Nazis into Jewish neighborhoods, Bonhoeffer got on German radio and spoke these lines: "Those who did not stand up for the Jews do not deserve to sing Gregorian chants." And what Bonhoeffer is saying, and I think also what guys like Rick Warren and Jim Wallace and Rich Cizik and my other friends in this movement are saying, is it's part of who we are as Christians to make sure that people of all backgrounds, including those who are not of our confession, can thrive in America. That's what America is about. That's what Christianity is about. And let me tell you, that's exactly what Islam is about also.
But why do you think it's important that people of faith should be engaged in our national dialogue? Why does faith need to be at the table? That seems to be what you're saying, that it should be a diversity of faith, but that faith should be at the table.
Well, over 90% of people in America say that they believe in God or some sort of higher power. 80+% say that religion is at least somewhat important in their lives. And in a democracy, what matters to people matters in the public life of a nation. And so if religion is important in people's lives, then it's going to be important in people's private lives, then it will likely be important in our public life. I think the question is not if religion is going to play a role, it's going to. The question is, what role is religion going to play? And I think one of the roles that religion should play is to make sure that we're building a country that lives up to the ideals of our founders, a country where people from all backgrounds can live in equal dignity and mutual loyalty. That's what we call pluralism at the Interfaith Youth Corps. And I think that if we're not digging deeply into what motivates people in huge ways, which is their religious traditions, we're missing out on a dramatic resource for the enrichment of our nation. And, you know, we're also living at a time in which religion is not neutral terrain. There are plenty of bad people playing on the terrain of religion. There are people who are using religion to divide people. There are people who are using religion to build barriers, to build bombs. If we're not using religion to build bridges, we forfeit that terrain to people who are doing really ugly things with it.
All right, let's take a call now from Ron in Salisbury, North Carolina. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Go ahead.
The question I have is, I'm sure that your guest is very familiar with the works of Dr. Samuel Huntington of Harvard in terms of the clash of civilizations as it relates to religion, as well as his views on the problems of assimilation of certain aspects of our immigration policy. I'd like to hear your views, the guest views on that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are you familiar with the work? I'm really not, so you'd have to explain it for me.
Oh, am I familiar with Professor Huntington's work in the Clash of Civilizations? What the Interfaith Youth Corps is really about, and what I think America is really about, is giving the lie to the Clash of Civilizations. The thesis of the Clash of Civilizations is simple. It's that people from different religious backgrounds cannot live in harmony with each other. Professor Huntington says that the post-Cold War world order is going to be defined by the divide and the war between people from different religions. What that is an eternal war. That is huge quantities of bloodshed. If 2 billion Christians and 1.3 billion Muslims are inevitably at odds with each other. And I just don't think that that's true. And we have to make sure in America and the rest of the world, we make sure it doesn't come true. We make sure that the clash of civilizations does not acquire the force of inevitability. One of the things that we think is most powerful to show that that's not true is young leaders who are bringing people from different backgrounds together. And you know, at the Interfaith Youth Corps, we train these young leaders all over the world to start their own interfaith projects, which are essentially anti-clash of civilizations projects. And let me tell you about one which I find really inspiring.
Give me a second before you do. I just want to remind our audience that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. All right, go ahead.
At the Interfaith Youth Corps, we have a fellows program. And one of our fellows at Wesleyan University was so inspired by the idea of Muslims fasting during the day for Ramadan, and we just got done with that month, and oftentimes giving the money that they would spend on food to charity, that she helped organize a fastathon herself, and she's Jewish. She found that the values of sacrifice and charity were deeply embedded in Judaism, just as they are in Islam. And she worked with her Muslim friends and colleagues at Wesleyan to organize a fastathon, and that raised over $11,000 for a local food pantry. I think that that's America, Jews and Muslims working together to serve others. And I think that can be an inspiring example to the Christians and Hindus who are fighting each other in India right now, to the Sunnis and Shias who are fighting each other in Baghdad, to the Protestants and Catholics who are at odds in Belfast, we can be a model of how different religious communities, including people from no religion at all, engage each other.
You're quite an optimist, I think, because some of these conflicts that you just talked about are really centuries-old conflicts, and some they eventually become political conflicts, but a lot of our political conflicts are based in religious conflict.
Well, you know, conflicts are not necessarily centuries old. Cooperation is also centuries old. You know, as my friend Zachary Carabel, the author of a great book called Peace Be Upon You, says, you know, you can read history any way you want to. You can read it as models of coexistence, or you can read it as chapters of conflict. And I think that the challenge before Americans today is which part of our history are we going to make real in the future? There's been religious conflict in America also. In Philadelphia in the last century, there was bloodshed on the streets between Catholics and Protestants over religious textbooks. But there's also been remarkable interfaith cooperation for social justice. I mean, I think about Martin Luther King Jr. and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marching together for civil rights in Selma. I think about King's great line that the Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist idea is that love is the supreme unifying principle of life. And that's the type of America that I want to help make real in the 21st century. That's the big focus that we've taken on at the Interfaith Youth Core.
Let's see if we can get one more call in here. Mary from Sacramento, California. Go ahead. Mary? Hello?
Oh, hi. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I am really interested in what your guest is speaking about today. And a lot of the quotes that he's giving are giving voice to what myself and my community that I surround myself with believe in recognizing the different views about heaven but live together on earth. So I'm hearing a recognition of the divide, but I'm curious as to what binds us together. Does your guest believe it's language?
Go ahead. I'm going to let him answer because we just have a little short time left. So go ahead, Ibu. Thanks for your call, Mary.
You're welcome.
Go ahead.
I think what binds us together as Americans is this notion that we inherit a nation built not on an ethnicity, built not on a religion, but on an idea. And a big part of that idea is that people from different backgrounds can live together in equal dignity and mutual loyalty. So I think that Thomas Jefferson speaks to us over the ages, and I think that George Washington does. And when James Madison says that religious freedom arises from the multiplicity of sects which pervades America and which is the best and only security for religious liberty in any society, that's a gauntlet thrown down to this generation. And, you know, America has stood in the world for equality and for freedom and for opportunity. And I think in the 21st century, we have to stand in the world for religious pluralism.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Ibu.
Thank you, Lynn.
Ibu Patel is the author of Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. He's also the director of the Interfaith Youth Corps, and his blog is called The Faith Divide. You've been listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.